this kind of ill will to her mother for just how difficult her life had been growing up, largely as a result of her mother's behavior. And so she was in my office telling me about this, and I said a very kind of psychologist-y thing. Well, it sounds like you need to work on forgiveness, right? And, that evening, I went online, and I thought, well, it might be nice to get her a kind of a book on forgiveness. And I found a book that it said it was by His Holiness. It's not really by His Holiness. It's by someone named Victor Chan, who I believe is in Vancouver, B.C., or was. But it was about His Holiness and had lots of interviews and things like that. And I got this for Adrienne because I knew she had expressed an interest in Buddhist spirituality. And I thought, well, it's on forgiveness. It's maybe a good fit for her. And it was sort of an odd thing. I think the website or whatever I was on had like a buy one, get one deal going or something. So I ordered one for her and one for me, right? As we do. And so I gave her that book. And in terms of her story, actually, she ended up taking a quarter off of college. She actually didn't enroll in classes for a quarter and spent that time and then the summer kind of being with her mother and kind of shepherding her passing, which was really good for her, and very for her to have that time was very important for her. And she and I still keep in touch. This has been many years ago now, some years anyway. But so I had this copy of the book for me too, and I read that, and I had been sitting around thinking about, okay, I need to do something about my anger. I'm modeling this stuff for my son that I would never want him to struggle with the way I have. And as I'm reading this book on His Holiness, I thought, well, wow, that's the kind of person, that's the kind of model I'd like my son to have. Does that make sense? That's the sort of father I'd like to be. Not like a leader of a worldwide religion, but just the kindness and the compassion and all of that stuff. And it was interesting because although the book was called The Wisdom of Forgiveness, it was a little different than I'd anticipated, because it was really about His Holiness working with basically forgiving the Chinese and for having basically being driven out of his homeland. So it spoke to very large themes. So anyway, that motivated me quite a lot. And oddly enough, in Spokane, Washington, where I live, as small as it is, there are actually quite a lot of really amazing opportunities to practice Buddhism, right? We've had several Buddhist centers in Spokane, and then the Abbey here was just kind of getting going about that time for me. And so, as I said, I kind of threw myself into Buddhist practice for 3 years pretty intensely. And after about 3 years, kind of reflected back, and I was hit with this sort of ethical quandary. And the ethical quandary I was hit with was that as I kind of reflected on how powerfully I had been changed by these practices, and I reflected on what were the practices that really, for me, seemed most powerful. It was the compassion practices, right? I felt like really those had been very transformative for me. And so the ethical quandary I hit was that I'm a clinical psychologist. I'm supposed to be helping people. I felt like I couldn't continue to work with clients in a way that didn't utilize any of this compassion stuff that I'd learned. But I hadn't learned any of that in the context of psychology. I'd learned it in the context of Buddhism, right? So I thought, so what do I do? Right? Now, I'm kind of a mediocre scientist. Right? I'm not a great scientist, and part of that has to do with the fact that I'm a predominantly teaching university, so literally 10% of our time is squirreled away for scholarship, and the rest is teaching and things like this. But I'm enough of a scientist to be sort of uncomfortable with just sort of reaching into a spiritual tradition, plucking out a set of practices out of context, and plopping them down in the therapy room. that felt actually really uncomfortable for me. And I think actually there's some, we're culturally facing a few challenges around the number of people who have done that with mindfulness, quite frankly. If you're familiar with, you've probably heard about mindfulness. It's everywhere on the cover of Time magazine. You know, it's almost like you go to McDonald's and get a Happy Meal, and it comes with a side of mindfulness. And the problem with the way that's done, I think, in many cases, is that when you pull the practices out of context and just try to apply them as a technique, you lose a lot, and then there are lots of misconceptions, and then there are problems that come with this. So I wasn't really comfortable with that. So I did sort of what we academics do, and I went to the literature. I did some literature searches, and because I thought, I can't be the only one. As transformative as these practices were, and as many Buddhists as there are in the world, I can't have been the only person in the field of psychology to have encountered these practices and said, this is important, right? So I started looking and came across the work of a psychologist named Paul Gilbert, who's been at the University of Derby in the UK for, you know, since the 80s, I think. And, you know, I was kind of, I've read a lot of things, and I read about Paul. And in the interim, I was looking at the field of psychology and what we had done with compassion. And I found very little. I found almost nothing. There's a psychologist named Kristen Neff who had talked about something called self-compassion. And that at that point was a little interesting to me, but I was less interested in a specific self-compassion than compassion for all beings. And of course, the self is a part of that. So self-compassion is a part of a larger kind of conception of compassion. And when I looked for that, I didn't find anything really. And so in science, one of the things, particularly in psychology, if you want to stimulate research in an area, one of the things you can do is to create a measure, right? Because, you know, we're not like physicists or chemists or things like this. Psychologists, you know, we can't study foot-pounds of force or milligrams of this or that. We study things like self-esteem and love and depression and anger and compassion, right? And these are things, before you can even begin to study them, you have to find a way to measure them, right? And so you're measuring these things that really don't even exist in the way like this cup exists, right? So it's very tricky. You've got to find a way to do it. So I initially thought, well, you know, since I don't find any literature on compassion, what I'll do is I'll create a measure of compassion. And once that's out there, then people will use it for research, and we can use it for research, and we'll kind of stimulate this area. And I even went so far as coming up with a pool of items. And actually, one of my first points of contact with Venerable Chidren and the nuns here at the Abbey was that I contacted the Abbey, and I said, hey, I'm developing this measure of compassion, of universal compassion. Would you be willing to look at the items and give me feedback? Because I thought, you know, there are people in the world that know a whole lot about compassion. It's just not psychologists yet. So I sent the item set up to Venerable Chidren, and she took a look at it, and she gave me some feedback, and she said, why don't you come up and visit, and we'll talk about this. And so I did, and met with the nuns, and we kind of went through the items, and I should probably finish that project up at some point, because it's still sitting on my computer. But there's a whole process that goes with designing a measure of something in psychology, a whole validation process. And, you know, that's not the part of research that really excites me in terms of validating measures. So right about that time, I came across a reference to Paul Gilbert and his work in a book by Jack Kornfield, who some of you may know is both a former Buddhist monk and a clinical psychologist. And he wrote a wonderful book. He's written many wonderful books, but he'd written one called The Wise Heart. And there was a reference to Paul's work in there. So I initially just thought that maybe, based on that reference, that Paul might have done a measure of compassion so that I didn't have to, basically. So I emailed Paul, and I said, hey, you know, I was reading The Wise Heart, and I saw you referenced in there, and it looked like you might have authored a measure of compassion. Do you have one? And he emails me back and says, no, and actually there aren't very good measures of compassion. There's this sociologist that did one, it's not very good, but you know, what I do have is this therapy model called compassion-focused therapy. And I'm doing a training in like mid-December. And if you're interested, you know, it's full, but if you're interested, you can fly over to England and I'll reserve you a spot. And, you know, I'll even put you up at my house. Mm-hmm. Which was kind of mind-blowing. I thought, oh my gosh, right? These compassion people are very nice. and Paul is, he's just a lovely human being. But, you know, it's interesting. It was right in the middle of my finals week. Right? Just as this, actually, is right in the middle of my finals week. And so I was going to beg off. I was going to email him and I was going to say, you know, I'd love to, but the timing doesn't work. You know, maybe another time. And I went home and my wife just looked at me. And I have her to thank for all of this. She said, Russell, this is what you want to do. You have to go. So I did. And what I found was that he had built a therapy model that was heavily influenced by Buddhism, particularly Tibetan Buddhism and compassion and compassion practices, but was couched in a scientific understanding of how human beings are, how we came to be in the world, and how we function. CFT is kind of halfway between science and Buddhism, probably about two-thirds in science, quite frankly, and about a third in Buddhism. But the thing that really stood out for me is that when you look at what various bodies of science say about what it means to have a human life, right? How we get to be the way we are through a scientific perspective, the struggles we'll all face, the difficulties that are always present in human lives, that compassion isn't just like a helpful thing to do. It's really the only response that makes sense. Because if you look at a human life, there's just, it involves a whole lot of pain. It involves a whole lot of discomfort. It involves a whole lot of suffering. I mean, this is a reality that you hear about quite a lot if you're a practicing Buddhist. Because that kind of approach to life is very different. In the West, it's sort of interesting. In the United States, our relationship with suffering is, I don't know if it's entirely unique in the world, but it's very different. Once I came across on the internet, I don't know if you've done any travel, sometimes you'll find little tip sheets for, you know, if you're an American visiting Japan, here's what you should know, right? Or if you're a, you know, if you're a Canadian visiting Italy, this is what you should know. And it's really good to read those because they kind of succinctly capture different aspects of cultures. So you get a lot of information so you can avoid making faux pas and, you know, things like that when you travel. And what I had come across was, it was a guide, I think it was for Japanese people visiting the United States. And it was really interesting to like have a view of our culture from the outside, from like what you should know if you visit the States. And it was so interesting and kind of entertaining that I got online and I did an internet search and I found like a dozen of these just from different countries, visiting the U.S. What you should know if you visit the States, and you know, to kind of understand people here. And you know, there were a lot of things on there that were kind of interesting to read, but one of the things that was really consistent just across all of them was that you know, what you should know about Americans, and you will find this at turns, you know. Irritating, confusing, but ultimately endearing. And so they will win you over with this, is that Americans are hopelessly optimistic. They honestly believe that everything will turn out okay. Right? Now, this was several years ago, so maybe it's different now. It is for me. But But the flip side of that, it said, but don't talk with them about suffering because they won't go there. They don't do that. Right? And I think they captured something really kind of core to our culture. You know, this is not the same in other cultures, right? You know, if you look at Russian literature, right? It's all about suffering. You know, I was talking with somebody else from another culture who was telling me, yeah, this is what we talk about all the time. But we don't really do that. In fact, there are lots of messages, I think, kind of woven throughout the culture. And I think it has to do a lot with advertising, quite frankly, that say that, you know, if you're suffering, if you're having a hard time of it, if you're struggling, you know, if you're scared or anxious or sad or angry or any of those things, then that's bad, right? That's really, there's something wrong with you, right? That you shouldn't feel like that, and then really you should very quickly do something about that so you don't feel that way anymore. Have you gotten those messages from the culture? Right. And it really, it's kind of a basis. I think it's a basis for advertising, right? To sell people things they don't need, you kind of have to convince people that their lives as they are not okay. Right? So you're too fat, or you're too thin, or you're too this, or you're too that. And if you'll only buy this, that'll make it better. Right? So there's been this, I guess in psychologists, we would say a pathologizing of discomfort, right? The idea that instead of taking the view that actually discomfort is a normal part of human life and is visited upon all of us, not infrequently, the more Americanized view of it is discomfort is bad and you should really not be uncomfortable. And if you are, that's something that's wrong and you need to fix it quick. And I think that the result of that kind of unspoken, kind of internalized cultural message is that it's a deepening of instincts we have anyway to pull back from pain. Right? We naturally kind of tend to do that anyway, right? If you happen to land your hand on a hot stove, you don't leave it there, right? You pull it back. And I think we have those kind of avoidant tendencies towards emotional experiences naturally as well. But I think those are really magnified by these cultural messages that encourage us to really believe that these emotions like sadness or fear or anger or anxiety are something that's wrong with us, right? We see them when they show up, not just as, oh, that's uncomfortable, but that's bad. I shouldn't feel that way. Have any of you had that experience of like recoiling from your own experience? Right. So the first thing I think it's important to recognize, and one of the things I want to do today with this talk is just kind of unpack compassion, what it is, and then, yeah, so we'll start with a general definition of what compassion is, and then get into, from a CFT perspective, like the various components, the things you kind of have to be able to do it well, right, to be able to actually behave compassionately in a way that's helpful. But I think that even before we talk about that, it's useful to recognize that suffering, discomfort, pain, these are normal parts of a typical human life. Right? Just to accept this, like, as the price of admission. Right? To get over this idea that I shouldn't have to feel this way. I shouldn't have to feel anxiety. I shouldn't have to feel sadness. I shouldn't have to feel whatever. And the reason I think that's so important is that any time we have an experience that shifts us into shame, and by shame I mean instead of going, you know, there's a difference between guilt and shame, and it's a very important difference, right? Both are kind of problematic, and they involve a healthy or a heavy self-preoccupation. It tends to be about me. But guilt is one of those things. If I do something that doesn't fit with the kind of person I want to be or that's hurtful to people I care about, I feel guilty, right? And some pain comes up in me, observing that I did that. And the pain motivates efforts toward reparation, right? The discomfort of guilt is one that's toward the behavior. I did something that I'm not okay with that was hurtful, and I want to do better, right? So I want to maybe apologize and then figure out, how do I not do that again? How do I not hurt that person again? Shame is very different. When shame comes up in us, there's this idea that I'm bad, or the fact that I did that means that I'm a bad person, or the fact that I feel that is something that's bad about me. And I think that experience of there's something wrong with me, is one of the most acutely painful human experiences there is. And our tendency is to, when that happens, when we feel something that causes us to go, oh, that's something that's wrong with me, our tendency isn't to lean in and look closer and figure out what would be helpful. Our tendency is to avoid. Our tendency is to pull back and to just not feel it, right? To not go there. And of course, we have developed a lot of strategies around not having to be in that place to avoid it. So for example, substance use, right? Drinking, using drugs. A lot of people use that as a way to avoid negative or uncomfortable emotions, right? My particular focus of work with compassion focused therapy begun in applying it to anger. And for a lot of people, not everybody, anger shows up in different ways, but for a lot of people, shame is woven into their experience of anger. So they'll do something that hurts someone they love. They see the other person is hurt, which brings up that acute sort of pain, that really painful shame experience. And so it's like, what do I do to avoid that? Well, there are lots of things we do to avoid that. One way is to blame the other person, to say, I only did that to you because you did da-da-da. Right? And that way, if I can blame you, then it's not my fault. Right? Then I'm not culpable, or I don't have to feel the discomfort that comes from the harm I did. Or we can rationalize it, right? Say to our friend, well, doesn't it make sense that I was angry? Right? That was okay, right? Or you'd be angry about that too, right? So we have lots of ways of avoiding suffering and distancing ourselves and not wanting to experience discomfort. But the problem with that is as you've probably figured out in your lives many times by now, when we avoid our problems, they don't go away. Right? If they're uncomfortable situations and difficulties, they don't go away. I can't remember the author that said this, but someone said, they don't go away. They go to the gym. Right? Right? When we avoid our problems, they go and work out and get bigger and get tougher. So compassion, I think that the ground underneath it is this acceptance that actually a human life is filled with discomfort, is filled with pain, is filled with moments in which we'll be uncomfortable or brokenhearted or anxious or whatever that is. And that the idea is that rather than avoiding that discomfort, trying to push it away or cover it up with whatever or distract ourselves by, you know, turning on the internet or the television, rather than turning away from it, we can turn towards it and look deeply into the discomfort and ask, okay, what are the causes and conditions that produce and maintain this? And then what can I do to help? What would be helpful? Right. So for me, compassion has a real rhythm. And that can be kind of self-compassion, but it can also be compassion for others. The first aspect of it is looking at what's happening and trying to understand, how does it make sense that this suffering is happening, right? What are the causes and conditions that produce and maintain it? And then, given this, what would be helpful? Right, so just to give you an example, based on your own experience, I'd like you to bring to mind a situation in which you've recently struggled. Maybe it was a situation that you feel a little ashamed about your own behavior in, a situation when you reacted in a way you're not comfortable with, or in a way that you're being self-critical about, or in a way that doesn't kind of fit with the person you want to be. Maybe it's just a situation that you were struggling in. You weren't doing very well. Or maybe you were feeling angry or afraid or ashamed or any of that stuff. So let me ask you, given what you know about you, given what you learned growing up, given the situation you were faced with growing up, given the things that have happened to you over the years, given the learning experiences you've had, the models you've had, the messages you got, does it make sense that you would have this struggle? Does it make sense that you would struggle in exactly this situation? I'll give you a hint. The answer to that question is always yes. Because our struggles don't occur in a vacuum. They occur in a context. So the idea behind that question really is to try and de-shame that struggle. To move from the fact that I struggled in this situation is something or says something or means something bad about me to, oh, of course I would struggle with this. Okay, I didn't choose to struggle with this. I didn't want to struggle with this. And yet, because of the way things have shaped up in my life, and if you're coming from a Buddhist perspective, you might say through the kind of continuity of lifetimes, right, the things that have led me here, I do struggle with this. What would be helpful? Given this, given that I struggle with this, predictably struggle with this, what would be helpful? So the essence of compassion, really, if I was to give you a kind of a definition of compassion that I think is consistent from kind of the model we use in CFT to Buddhist teachings, things like this. It's being moved by suffering or having a sensitivity to suffering combined with a motivation to alleviate it and prevent it. Right? I like being moved. I think that in CFT the strict definition we use is a sensitivity to suffering combined with a motivation to alleviate it. I like the idea of being moved by suffering because it implies a felt experience on the part of the individual who's experiencing compassion. The idea is you see the suffering, and that suffering in others or suffering in the self, and there's a little bit of heart sink. There's a little bit of, oh, wow, that's really hard. And that fuels kind of a motivation to then do something about it. So what I thought it would be useful to do is to talk about when, let's say you've got that part, right? You see suffering and you're like moved by it and you want to help, right? You want to help yourself or somebody else in that suffering. What are the things we need to be able to do? What are the things that need to be happening there that allow us to work skillfully in that situation? Before I start unpacking those things, though, I'd like to kind of put it out to you and see, are there any questions? Or we've got a little more flexibility in here. Usually when I do these talks, they're videotaped, right? And they throw them up on YouTube. So I kind of feel this obligation to do it as a talk, right? So someone watching it on YouTube could just watch it and, like, they're there. And that's good and bad. I mean, it's good because it, like, gets it out there. But the challenge is it means it tends to be a little less interactive because, you know, the camera doesn't really capture everybody. But the nice thing is about not being videotaped here is that we're not really constrained in that way. So we can be a little more interactive. So I'm curious what sort of thoughts were coming up for you during the first, you know, I was going to say a few minutes, but it's been a half an hour, goodness. It's a great thing about being a university professor. You can kind of talk indefinitely. So what was coming up for you? Any thoughts, questions, comments, anecdotes, jokes?
I guess I can just comment this idea that, and it's quite popular, or it's quite common with popular culture, that you can just take something, pick it up, plop it somewhere else, and then start to work with it out of context. And you see that everywhere. And I've actually often felt that about mindfulness, because Buddhist mindfulness is actually, there's a lot more with going on there. But having said that, it is helpful to be mindful. So that is a comment.
I think the difference for me, I think that the kind of westernized packaging of mindfulness, it's so much smaller than what it is when it's in the context of Buddhist practice. But what I find is that sometimes you'll see these articles like the dangers of mindfulness, right? Things like this. And when you read it, what it really is the danger of mindfulness practiced out of context by people who don't really understand what it is. It's like, cars, if you're driving them and you know how to drive them, are not terribly dangerous. But if you put a 4-year-old in one and don't teach them how to use it, there can be problems. So, I think that point's well taken. We do that a lot. It's a kind of commodification of things. And actually, that's one of my motivations around compassion. And actually, Venerable Chodron and I wrote a book together a few years ago called An Open-Hearted Life. And part of the motivation behind that book, which is not a psychology book, really. It's a book on compassion, just for anybody, really, was to try to avoid doing that with compassion. I wanted to put something out there that would communicate compassion in a way that was kind of fully contextualized in terms of its history and traditions, both in psychology and more broadly in Buddhism, which is why I invited Venerable Chodron to write the book with me, because I wanted to put it out there in that way. I think... I do fear that that's kind of happening a little bit with compassion. And the danger of that for compassion for me is that it'll become like a trend. It'll be something that's really, people, compassion for like 2 or 3 years, and then we're on to, whatever else. Integrity or gratitude or something. But actually, I'm not knocking gratitude. There's tons of data around gratitude and the importance of that. So, but the point is, we'll move through these virtues as the sexy new thing in the culture, and that they won't stick. They won't actually transform the culture, which is, particularly with compassion, I think what's dramatically lacking. I mean, if we look out at how, the things that are going on in the world, and most particularly the things that are going on in this country, there's a notable absence of compassion. It's easy to kind of pin that on Trump and the people who support him, but actually I think that kind of contingent has really tested the compassion in lots of other people too.
Exactly.
Because I know a lot of people who have tremendous compassion for everybody but Trump voters.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Right.
And it's like, it's okay to loathe them. And that's not really what compassion's about, right? It's not saying, I have compassion for my people and people who do stuff that I'm uncomfortable with. And actually what happens is it just fuels the division that makes all this possible to begin with. So it's tricky. Other thoughts?
I was thinking, because I didn't find a lot of justification for my anger, either if I came from family that's kind of violent. But that's the same thing, it's the opposite thing in my country. We see suffering all the time, that is okay because we are humans. And you're going to heaven because you are suffering so much that you are going to heaven. So it's okay. Just feel pity because it's not compassion, and feel envy because they are being not rape, or they are being physical violent or threatened. It's okay. They are going to heaven. No? So it's the other way. We see the suffering and we actually can talk about all the time, but it's just like it's something normal. And so that is what actually tricks my own things. Like, I don't feel like it's normal, this suffering, fear that it's okay, and use the religion's belief to justify that someone is angry because it's suffering. And 14 is rare, no? So I don't really know, because it's really difficult to break that misconception that we already grew up, no? It's in the homes and the families, because it's like more Catholic country. So it's from home to high school. You have teachers in your high school telling you the same things. Like, okay, fine. And you can find the same thing sometimes in college. Like, if you go for a regular class, there is no sociology or things like that, you don't go out from the same partner. And it's quite difficult to break that. And I just realized that, like, oh, yeah, I was somehow trying to break the same cycle, but somehow I'm still thinking that it's okay. So for some times, because you did bad things, no? Like, that's quite something in my mind.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think that's an important point, too. Because, you know, I've been talking about how American culture just sort of denies and avoids suffering. But the other thing you can do, really, is just be resigned to it. Just kind of resignation, just, oh yeah, this is what it is, and we'll feel bad for ourselves when it happens to us, and we'll feel bad for others when it happens to them. But we're not really going to do anything about it. Right? And there are actually lots of different cultures that are like that, too. There are different cultures that still have, you know, very distinct castes, you know. And you know, if you're in that lower caste, and you're there, and you're begging, and you're suffering, it's like there's this cultural acceptance of that's just the way it is, and there's no need to help them. That's just their lot in life. That's what they were born into. That's the way it is for them. And so, you know, we pity them, but we're not really going to do anything. Right? And so that's not compassion, really, right? Compassion is looking at the suffering and going, okay, there it is. What can I do about it? And I think that's really important. Sometimes when you say acceptance, people think resignation. People think acceptance means I'm not going to do anything. Acceptance in the context of compassion and mindfulness really is opening your awareness to the way things actually are. Right? And the idea is that we have to have that before we can do anything about it. So it's not a passive process. Right? It's not like resigning or giving yourself over to it. But I think, could you tell me your name?
Aiti.
I think the point you're making is really important. That we learn, we can spend our whole lives learning these kind of lessons from the culture that get in the way of being compassionate. And so part of learning to do this is unlearning that stuff, or being able to realize that, you know, just because that's what everyone thinks or everyone says or everyone doesn't say, that doesn't mean it's right. That doesn't mean that's the way to live. Other? Yeah?
Yes, thank you, Russell, for everything that you've shared. Thought-provoking. My name is Sharima, and I'm a chaplain, and I'm from Flint, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And everything you've just described would exactly describe what has been happening in my hometown the last few years.
It's terrible.
Crisis.
Yeah.
So for the last couple of years, I've been, I was based in Flint until January, as an activist there, and offering my own version of chaplaincy and activism together, as a chaplain activist as well. And what you just described is exactly the government, the state government, which created the Flint water crisis and the people. And so because the whole city was put on bottled water, which just ended in April, 2.5 years before all of our pipes would be completely replaced. So we've got more than 20,000 lead pipes that have to be replaced, and we're only about 7,000 in right now. And they've just ended the bottled water in Flint.
Sure.
So this type, what you're talking about, you know, the suffering, that's always somebody else's problem, even though it was the state government that created the crisis, and the Flint residents who will now live infinitesimally with the results of having been exposed to the more than 8,000 0-to-6-year-olds, more than 10,000 children altogether, including those who were in vitro at the time. So, and then in our seniors and everybody in between. And so in terms of Flint residents understand suffering, and the government, you know, above might get it to an extent, but they are going to, you know, not claim responsibility for that. And so, you know, Flint is now, you know, trying to rebuild, trying to come back from that. And there are many people there in Flint who, you know, like you were saying, are coming coming to it from a perspective of what can we do. And there were those who came to Flint with that perspective. What can I say? What do I have to say to the residents of Flint? What do I have to do when the governor was not even asking that question? And the governor and all of the people in town created the crisis. So I'm really resonating with what you're talking about in terms of the compassion-based therapy, compassion-focused therapy. Because I think that in some ways, myself and others too, including our residents who had to become activists, who had to become citizen scientists, because the Michigan Department for Environmental Quality was consistently putting out reports that the water was fine, and the citizens knew it wasn't. So they had to create their own, they had to be their own resources for truth. And so in having that compassion for one another, it's incredibly complicated, but in some ways it's clear you're able to clearly see that level of compassion, especially when it rises to the top, and when those appear at the top, it's not coming down.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that you described is a kind of a, it sounds like a coming together in Flint, people coming together,
yes,
supporting one another, because the people up there aren't doing it.
Powers that be were not listening. And so that was the activism that I tended to, that I purposed to offer as a chaplain, was to listen, because the powers that be were not listening to the people. And so I purposed that any story anyone wanted to share with me about their experience of the water, whether it was their own or their children's or their parents, all of it, I would listen. And so, and I did that. I did other things too. I did a lot of other stuff too. But that, I guess I'm really appreciating what you're saying, because it's also a part of compassion that maybe in terms, sometimes I didn't have compassion for myself, and then other times I certainly had no compassion at all for her and for those all in between. So.
Yeah, and the truth of the matter is, everybody in that situation, I mean, it was just a horrible situation.
It was, and it is. Yeah.
You think, okay, well, they're denying culpability because they don't want 8,000 lawsuits or whatever coming their way. But on the other hand of this, okay, you're the governor. You don't have the money to fix this.
That's right.
20,000 lead pot, you know.
Yep.
What do you do? I mean, it's really a horrible situation. And it's nice that at some point, it sounds like largely as a result of the people of Flint, that actually there was a national recognition even that, This is happening.
That's
this is a real thing.
That's right. There were other communities that came forward and said, we've had our own water crisis for so long. And so others have said that it was probably because of the activists, that because the activists were so vocal and they were so present that they were able to not only raise awareness for our own issues, but for other communities in the country who've been actually having it longer than we have.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your experience. Other thoughts or comments?
I have something.
Yeah.
I don't know, because I'm looking at this, like an outsider, if I'm living here, try not to criticize, because I will feel bad. That's true, I feel bad about that. Last year, like by the end of college, I started writing about how bad is the high school teachings here. And you will have to apologize me, but it's really bad. Like, I was looking at a video, how 60% of the new generation is killing themselves, either suicide, anorexia, or bulimia, just three. The next generation, no mind, I know about that one. Like, these teens, they don't want to be here, they don't want to grow up, and there is nothing about that, probably. Nothing in high schools, nothing in public health. And I was like, I asked my teacher, so how someone in high school cannot notice there are a few teenagers going through these issues, like, or not coming back because they just killed themselves. Just only in Utah, beginning of this year, 60 teenagers commit suicide. And Utah is not even good town because there are hole and things in the town, everything is outside. And he said, well, if it is that good, how you didn't realize the 16 teenagers just killed themselves? And I was like, okay, I know we are in developing country, but the first thing that a teacher do with anyone in class is, what is happening to you? You look sad. At least that happens on my situation. Like, you realize right away that something was going on with the other, because the teacher was the first person and realized that, oh, someone is getting tired and dying and dying. And so we actually talk about these problems, and one of our big problems is pregnancy on teenagers, and there's news, and every knows that South America has a lot of teenagers pregnant. But no one's talk about North America losing the next new generation because they're just too depressed, or I don't know what is wrong. But the problem is they didn't find anything about that, just one video on Netflix. I don't really remember who did the video and showed the statistics that is actually quite a lot. Just no one talks about that. And I was thinking, I don't know if it's compassion or something else is missing from the bottom, because something is really missing there.
I think that fits in very closely with kind of what I was talking about before. Because if you ask someone, are you okay? Are you feeling sad? And they say, I am really sad. Then you have to deal with that, right? Mm-hmm. Then you know something and you need to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So I think we could go through example after example after example of these kind of cultural problems that we have here that we do. We don't really, I mean, you know, from shootings to, as you said, the rates of depression in young people and things like that have gone up dramatically. And actually, it's not a mystery, actually, as to why that has happened. So, for example, I think the rates of depression in adolescents almost doubled. And you can track it back to 2007, which is almost exactly the time when every teenager had a cell phone, had a mobile phone. Now, that's correlation, right? You can't say this causes this. But I think what you find is that we have a lot of teenagers who are living in a world where they're experiencing far fewer real human connections and a lot more just online activity that doesn't meet those needs and help people feel safe, but also fuels things like eating disorders, because you're constantly bombarded with imagery and messages about how you should be. But, I mean, it's not just that. I mean, if you look at rates, and it's not just the states either. If you look at rates of sexual assault and sexual harassment in this culture, they've been extraordinarily high for an incredibly long time. And as a culture, you know, you've got largely, you know, female activists who have talked about it for decades. But as a culture, we almost just kind of accept that, okay, yeah, this is how it is. This is what it's like. Right? And if you're male, you don't even grasp. Most men don't even get the extent of the problem. I mean, I actually, at the university, I've been really happy to see the Me Too movement kind of blowing up. I think it's so important, because I think we're moving from a point where sexual harassment and, in many cases, sexual assault occurs in the shadows, where it's not talked about, where it's just something that women and girls just kind of have to put up with. It's just a part of the culture, to one in which if you're going to sexually harass or sexually assault someone, you have to know you're going to be named and there are going to be consequences. And it's sad that that's how it has to happen. Quite frankly, I would hope that sexual harassment and sexual assault would stop, because men think, okay, this isn't how I want to treat women. This isn't what I want to do. But if it has to start by the men who would doing that stuff being afraid of the consequences when they're named, then let it start there.
Amen.
Right? And I guess the good thing about that is it has actually created an impetus for people to talk about it.
Right.
I've had these, and I always was going to have these conversations with my son, but I've got a son who's 12 years old, and he was 11 when all these stories started coming out, and that's, you know, he had just a year or two before learned what intercourse was and about, you know, sex and all that stuff. And so we talked to him about Right. Then we talked to him about sexual harassment, and we talked to him about all those kinds of things, and we talked about him, okay, what kind of man do you want to be? Right? Because they're the men that do this stuff. They're the men who kind of silently stand there and do nothing about it, which really empowers the people who do it. And then they're the men who say, no, that's not okay, and try to change it. Which one of those do you want to be? And then we talk about, so what do you do if you hear a friend making some horribly sexist joke? Or what do you do if someone says something like this? Or what do you do if someone says someone like that? And I think there are a lot more conversations beginning to happen. But I think you're absolutely right. We don't talk about this stuff. I think a lot of the other part of it, quite frankly, is that, and I can't contrast with South American culture. I'm going to be going to Argentina, I think, in a year to do a workshop. I'm excited about that. I don't know much about South American culture at all. But I think here, there is really this kind of emphasis around go, 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 do, do, do. Right? And I think there are a lot of people in the States and probably other Western nations who are just racing so much just to do all the stuff they have to do on their to-do list that it's very hard. If I see you and I see your suffering, I may want to stop, but gosh, if I spend an hour talking to you, that's three things I don't get done. Does that make sense? So the teacher, I mean, it's hard. Okay, if I see a kid, and I talk to teachers, I spend, during the school year, I spend an afternoon a week at Ferris High School, right, on the South Hill in Spokane. And Ferris is a tricky high school because it has the full economic range. It has kind of the richest of the rich and the poorest of the poor and everything in between. And so I talk with teachers. I've actually had teachers say to me, I see this kid, I can tell they're having a hard time. I want to connect with them and help them. And it's hard to do that because I have 20 other kids in there that I'm supposed to be teaching too. What do you do? Well, there are solutions to these problems, right? There are ways, and actually I know at Ferris, they're working on that, right? But there are other schools, and there are other schools that are working on it too, but I think we need to prioritize these things culturally more. That's why I'm really interested in how do we infuse compassion into the culture? How do we kind of, you know, I just want to just put it into the water. How do we help people help people care and be sensitive to one another's suffering and to want to help? I think one of the things that we have to do culturally to get at that is to look at the sources of threat in people's lives. And this is something, one of the things we talk about in compassion-focused therapy, which I think can be helpful for folks, as we conceptualize emotions, or we group emotions according to evolutionary function. Right? So the idea of why do I have these feelings really is rooted in our ancestors' survival. Right? We have emotions because at some point in the human story they were useful. Right? The people who had those emotional responses tended to survive, and the ones that didn't. Right? That's why we have these sorts of things. So we tend to group emotions and basic motivations into three systems. The first we call the threat and self-protection system, or the threat system for short. Now, these are emotions like anger, fear, anxiety, disgust, right? And they're emotions that evolved to help us very rapidly identify things that threaten us and then respond to them. So if you notice, when you feel scared or you feel angry or you feel disgusted, there are really strong action tendencies associated with that, right? You're not like just sitting there angry or afraid or disgusted. You're wanting to do something, right? I want to lash back, or I want to get the heck out of Dodge, or I want to turn away from whatever that thing is, right? And the reason for that, by the way, is that that's the parts of your brain that evolved to help us deal with threat trying to protect you. And one of the reasons that we think this communicating in this way is important is that a lot of times those are the sorts of emotions, fear or anger or whatever, that people look at and think that's something that's bad about me, they feel ashamed of. But actually, if you struggle with one or more of these emotions, it's not that there's something wrong with you, it's actually that the threat protection systems in your brain are working really hard to protect you. The problem is, in the modern world, those of us who are in you know, kind of first world countries where we can basically, in the States, not even everyone can say this. There are a lot of people who can't, but those of us who do have physical safety generally live in a safe place and have access to food and the basics, right?
White.
Well, yeah. White, although there are a lot of white people in this country who don't have all those things too. That's one of the reasons politically we're in the state that we are, is that I think there are a lot of people who had miserable lives under the previous three presidents, the three administrations, and said, well, let's just burn the whole thing down. I mean, you know, let's just roll the dice and see, because, you know, it hasn't mattered which party was in charge. You know, my family still didn't have food to eat. But for many of us, you know, probably most of the people in this room, the threats that present themselves in our lives, those teenagers at the high schools, the threats that show up in their lives, are not the threats that our emotions evolved to deal with. Right? They're not the kind of threats that you can fight off or run away from or freeze and they go away. Right? They're much more complicated social threats, and they're economic threats, and they're, you know, they require calm kind of nuanced responses rather than really activated emotional responses. So it's not that those threat emotions are something that's wrong with us. It's just that they're better suited to earlier times in the human story than they are now. Now, the other part of it that can be tricky with those threat emotions is that they really evolved to be very rapid on, rapid off, that to work in that sort of way. So the idea is this threat presents itself, we respond to it, and then it's one example that I probably use here every year because I like it so well. I live in an area of Spokane that's got some, behind our house there's kind of pine forest. So we don't have a backyard, because if we did, we don't have a fence rather, if we had a fence, our yard would be very, very small and wouldn't be so nice. So, but if you leave the fence off, you feel like you're sitting out in the woods, right? When the woods, we don't own the woods, they're just this kind of green belt behind us. But the consequence of us not having a fence is that sometimes we're out in the backyard and our dogs are out there too, another dog will wander through, right? And we've got two dogs. We've got a little one called Vera Wag and a bigger one named Gwen. And, you know, I want you to imagine Gwen. How many of you have dogs or have spent time around animals like this? So dogs are very territorial, right? Dogs have a very strong sense of this is my place, you know, and say bark at people who wander by and things like that. So if another dog will wander in our backyard, what'll happen is very predictable. Gwen, kind of our bigger dog, will have an initial threat response, and she will size up the other dog. She'll try to figure out, is this a situation I can handle or not? And if the dog isn't too big and mean looking, she'll do a threat display, right? She'll growl or bark or, you know, just snarl. The kind of cackles on the back of her neck will come up. You know, she'll make a threatening posture, right? As if to say, hey, this is my yard. You just move along, buddy, right? Have you seen the dogs do that, right? On the other hand, if it's a big, mean dog, right? If it really, she knows she's not going to she'll do a display of submissiveness. Now, if you've seen a dog do that, you get down really low, kind of hunch up against the ground, almost as if to say, no, it's okay. No one needs to get hurt. Make yourself at home. Right? So it's just her way of dealing with this threat, right? Fight or freeze. So, she's not going to flee because it's her yard. So let's imagine this dog kind of sniffs around the yard a little bit, you know, pees on a tree, and then eventually gets bored and wanders off. 5 minutes later, how is Gwen? She's fine. Yeah, she's back to normal. She's like, see how I ran off that other dog? Right? Even if all she did was wait until it wandered off. She's like, hey, can I have a treat? You know, she's looking for a scratch. She's fine. And the reason is that her threat system worked in exactly the way that evolution designed. Right? Threat appeared, it activated, threat, you know, was sustained for the duration of the threat, threat disappears, she's back to normal. Right? Okay, so same situation, only it's you, right? You're at your house or your apartment or your Buddhist center, right? And some stranger just comes barging in, right? They just walk in, start looking around, right? Making themselves at home. My guess is that your initial response would be very much like Gwen's. I think you'd look at them and you'd size them up. Right? You would. You'd size them up. You'd be like, okay, you know, is this a situation I can handle? Right? I don't know. So, you know, if it seems like it's a situation you can handle, like maybe it looks like, you know, you're in an apartment building and maybe it's your next door neighbor who had a couple pints too many and they just wandered into the wrong room. You might say, excuse me, right? This is my place. I'm gonna go ahead and ask you to move along now, right? All right. You might do an assertive kind of display to let them know this is my territory and, you know, get along. On the other hand, let's imagine that this is someone who's big and scary, right? They walk in and maybe they've got a couple big guns, right? I would guess, again, you would respond very much the way Gwen did. You'd do a display of submissiveness, wouldn't you? You'd say, look, I don't know what you want. No one needs to get hurt here, right? Maybe got some drinks in the fridge. You can help yourself to them, you know, whatever you need. Now, let's imagine that same situation, that this person kind of wanders around your house a little bit, maybe grabs a cold drink from the fridge, gets bored, wanders off. 5 minutes later, how are you? 5 hours later? Right. Maybe 5 days later, you're feeling slightly better as you're watching them install the new alarm system. Right? So what's different? What's happening that's different between you and Gwen? Because 5 minutes later, she's fine, but we're not. So what's happening?
Coming up with all kinds of stories in our heads.
Yeah. That's right, because you have something that Gwen doesn't have. You have this fancy new brain. You've got these frontal lobes here that don't just react or respond to situations, but assign meaning to them. Think about them, turning around in your mind. We can do mental time travel, right? We can go back and relive it, playing the situation over again and again and again. We can project into the future, imagining what if he comes back? What could happen then? We can ask questions like, why me? We can imagine what could have happened, even though it didn't happen. We can create really nuanced and horrific imagery around what could have happened or what might happen, right? And so this is very important. One of the things that happens when evolution happens is that when we evolve new capacities, it's not like the old ones fall away, right? It takes a very long time for that to happen. I mean, we've even got organs that don't really do anything for us anymore, right? So as we evolved, these new capacities to think and assign meaning and create those stories that you're talking about, we still have the same old ancient emotional architecture that is designed to very quickly produce emotions like anger and fear in response to signs that there's a threat. And that will tend to do that as long as those signals that there's a threat there. So the tricky bit is that, you know, Gwen, the signals she's getting about threats come from the outside world, come through their eyes and ears, right? And so once those threat signals are gone, the neural architecture that produces those emotions is no longer being stimulated, right? Now, so that she can come right back to baseline. But the problem is, although our threat response can be kicked off by an experience from the outside world, what can happen is that those emotions that are produced, anger and fear, tend to then trigger thoughts and mental imagery that fuel the very emotion that trigger them, right? So if we're anxious, we're thinking about what could happen, we could imagine it going wrong, we're picturing it happening again and again, or picturing what could happen next time, and all those thoughts are fueling the parts of the brain that produce the emotions, and we get in these loops where it just continues, right? Or if we're angry, right? Someone says something that makes us, you know, triggers a threat response, and we feel a little angry, Then we play it again and again in our minds, like watching it over and thinking, well, they can't talk about it. They don't even respect me at all. No one can talk. I'm not going to put up with that. And all that fuels the emotions, right? So we can get in these loops. That's why for us, it's very easy to get tricked or to get captured, rather, by these kind of experiences of threat. Now, that can be really tricky, but the wonderful thing about these kind of new brain capacities we have is that we also have the capacity to be aware that that is happening. We can look at it and go, oh my gosh, I'm feeling really angry, or I'm feeling really scared, and I'm thinking all of this stuff, which makes complete sense, but is functionally fueling that experience of being angry and being scared. Right? And so what we can do once we're aware of that, once we notice, instead of attacking ourselves for all of it, what if we just say, huh, okay, these thoughts I'm having are not terribly helpful. They're keeping me in this state of whatever. What would be helpful? Right? And that therein is where we can learn ways to work with those situations. That rather than being hijacked by the way our brains have evolved and how they to work, we can kind of take control of it. Because we can't choose how to feel, but we can choose how to think. If we recognize what happens, we can think. And so in compassion-focused therapy, as with Buddhism, there's a strong emphasis on cultivating ways of thinking that are compassionate, that are kind, that are wise. So instead of being trapped in a prison of our thoughts, we can take, when we see that process happening, we can take control of it and say, oh, okay, I'm fueling my sense of anger here. Right? So what would be helpful? So one way to do that, quite frankly, if you actually talk to people, what you find is actually we have a lot of intuitive wisdom about what would be helpful. We just often don't apply it to ourselves. Right, but I would encourage you, like, the next time you're really having a problem with something, the next time you're struggling, and particularly if you're struggling in a way where you're, like, criticizing yourself, you're shaming yourself, you're saying, oh, this is bad about me, or I can't believe I did that, or I'm a bad, you know, husband, wife, daughter, parent, friend, whatever. If you imagined, what if, instead of that being me that's feeling that, what if this was someone I dearly loved, someone I really cared about, someone I only wanted to support and encourage and validate and be there for, someone I only wanted to help. What would I say to them? What would I want them to understand if they were struggling with exactly this? Because I'm willing to bet that you, many of you anyway, when you're struggling or when you're having a hard time, say things to yourself in your head that you would never say to someone you cared about. Am I right? Yeah. We tend to do that. So what if you could imagine? So if I'm doing psychotherapy, a lot of times I'll even do chair exercises where I'll have my client imagine. And there's something about this that's really powerful. I'm not quite sure why it is. If I just ask the person, what would you say to someone that you really cared about to help them through this? You know, they can talk through it, but it seems to stay in that kind of intellectual kind of realm. But if I say, okay, I want you to sit here. This is the compassionate chair. And I want you to look, and in this chair is this person. I want you to imagine this person that you deeply care about, that you really love. They're sitting right here. Just imagine them that they're sitting here. And the thing with humans is we're pretty good at imagining stuff. I mean, it's pretty amazing how we can give things symbolic value and imagine things. So, for example, I mean, this is crazy. Look at this, right? Clearly a cup. It's got some water in it. I want you to imagine that this is a pumpkin. How many of you are just very clearly right now imagining this is a pumpkin? It's so easy for you, right? It's just amazing. It's miraculous, right? So we can harness these sort of kooky abilities we have. So I'll have someone, see here, I'll have them actually look at this chair and imagine, here's this person that you really care about, that you really love, who's struggling so much with whatever this thing is.
that's coincidentally is remarkably similar to what you're struggling with, what would you want them to understand? How would you support or encourage them? What would you say to them? And instead of having them talk about what they might say, I'll have them look at this person, imagine them there, and actually say it. And actually do it. Or, and this is a little more advanced, imagine looking at the struggling version of them. Or that version of you when you were 8 years old and you were being abused. Or that version of you that was hurt in that situation. What would you want her to know? What would you say to him? And there's something about doing it that way that makes it really powerful in a felt way. It doesn't just stay up here, right? One of the most powerful moments I ever had was in a CFT group, and one of my clients who had been dealing with all kinds of anxiety and all sorts of shame around it sat there and looked at himself, at that anxious version of self, and he said, "There's nothing wrong with you." And if you could have seen the faces of people in the group, it was so powerful. Because this is someone who had lived his whole life thinking that there was something wrong with him. Now, one of the things we're going to need to be able to do if we're going to actually be compassionate in the real world, and actually if we're going to set ourselves up to respond compassionately naturally, we have to learn to help ourselves feel safe. And this is one of the reasons why I think the concept of, not the concept, but the Sangha is really important, having a community, because as human beings, we really evolved to feel safe with other people through connection with people who accept us, like us, and care about us. By the way, I talked about the threat system, right? Threat emotions. We're now bridging to talk about a different system, which in CFT we call the soothing and safeness system. Now, the other system that I'll just mention briefly is called the drive system, and that's about pursuing goals. So that's being excited, interested, engaged. Anytime you're like, ooh, I want that, or I want to do that. These are the emotions that keep us oriented on goals and keep us working towards the things we want to accomplish. Now, the thing that's worth mentioning about those threat emotions, and drive emotions to a lesser extent, is that when we experience them, anger, fear, disgust, things like this, there's a marked narrowing of our attention and our thinking and reasoning. And this is very important to notice. When we feel threatened, we're not going to be good at compassion. We're not going to be good at taking care of others. We're going to have a real hard time with that. And the reason, it's not our fault. The reason is when we feel threatened, naturally, and this is an evolved capacity, right? Our focus goes very narrowly to whatever the perceived threat is. And it makes sense, right? Again, if you're, you know, ancient human wandering through the savanna and there's a tiger, do you want to be distracted? Do you want your attention and your thinking and reasoning to be all over the place? No, you want it focused on that tiger, right? Because, you know, if you're focused on the tiger, maybe you can find a way to fight it off, or maybe you can find a getaway. Find a way to get away, right? If you see the tiger and you think, oh, that's not bad. Oh, look, a pretty flower, right? Look who just got eaten, right? So this is why, you know, when these emotions come up in us, it makes us very hard to do other things, right? This is why if we're going to help people, one of the first things we need to do, if we're going to help people help themselves, we have to help them feel safe. Because when people feel safe, the opposite happens. It opens up. When we feel safe and connected, we think reflectively. We're more creative. And one of the things that's really nice is in a vacuum, one of the beautiful things about compassion is something that arises naturally in us. It's woven into us. And when people feel safe, we naturally tend to be compassionate and pro-social and helpful. We do. There's this whole line of research that shows when you can activate what's called attachment security in people. So, for example, one way to do that would be just to ask you,
Bring to mind someone you know that just loves you and accepts you. And maybe that's another human being, maybe it's not. Human relationships can be complicated, and there are a lot of people that don't have anyone that they can pull up that they feel like that. So for me, if I was struggling with that, it doesn't have to be a person. It could be my dog, Vera Wang, right? Because she only loves me. That's all she wants, is to be with me and to be around me and to snuggle with me. That's it. That's all she wants, right? And what happens is when people bring to mind those experiences of really being cared about, then this capacity for thinking reflectively and creatively and being compassionate and helpful, it just shows up. And there are all kinds of studies that show that when you do that, just like that brief intervention I did where I asked you to bring someone to mind that really cared about you, they found that when you do that to one group of people and have another group of people think about something else, something neutral, that these people are significantly more compassionate, altruistic, pro-social, creative. Right? So when we feel safe, it opens up these capacities. So part of preparing ourselves and preparing others to feel compassionate is to reduce the amount of threat that they feel and help them feel safe. Right? On the other hand, when we're threatened, we tense up and we're focused on the threat, and it can be very difficult to do things like perspective taking. Right? When I feel threatened, it's very hard for me to imagine how you're making sense of things or what you care about. Right? When the people of Flint have no water, it's very hard for them to imagine what's going on in the mind of the governor or to care. Right, it's almost impossible, you know. Which is actually one of the reasons I think it's because of culpability. You know, I wish our leaders would sometimes just come a little more clean with us and say, this is a huge problem and I want to solve it. In fact, if I could, I'd solve it tomorrow. But here's the thing. This is we're going to require billions of dollars that we don't have yet. And we're going to work like hell to get that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the meantime, we need to find solutions to minimize the damage.
Yeah, there was nothing like that.
There was nothing like that. And of course, the reason there isn't probably is they're like, their lawyers are saying, if you say that, you'll be sued. But I do think if they can communicate some caring, even if I can't do something right now that fixes it, you're heard, I understand the suffering, and I am committed to help.
Yes, that's right.
You know? And that's a big part of compassion. Sometimes we can't make things better for people. Sometimes there's no fix. And all we can say is, this is horrible. And I hear you and I'll be with you. I want to listen to you. And actually, in psychotherapy, one of the things you learn is, even when there is a fix, even when there is a solution, if we rush too quickly to that without actually acknowledging people's feelings and suffering, it's not very helpful for them. Right? As a therapist, there are times when I know if this client would only stop doing this and do this instead, their lives would be so much better. But if they come in and they're telling me, oh, I've got all this horrible suffering, and I immediately say, okay, well, here's the thing. Stop doing this. Do this. Your life will be better. How helpful do you think that is? It's not helpful at all. They need to know that I understand their suffering first. I need to be able to hear what their experience is and reflect my experience of that experience in a way that helps them know that I get it, that I actually get how hard this is for them. Right? And why is that? Well, that's how we feel safe, through connection. And that's one of those things that's a lot easier for some people than for others, depending on our backgrounds. Right? So one of the areas of science that compassion-focused therapy draws from is it's called attachment theory. And I should say, in that kind of field of psychology, it means something very different. Attachment in that context means something very different than when Buddhists say attachment. Right? So it's not like attachment, like, this is my cup and I can't be happy without it. Attachment. It has to do with how we feel connected to other people. And as far as we can tell, about 60% of people are what we call securely attached. And if you're securely attached, what that means is that when you were very young, like 1 to 3 years old, and beyond, but particularly when you were very young, you had a caregiver who responded to your distress signals consistently with nurturing, right? So over time, what you learned is that when you're hurting, people will be there to help. actually, you think it's just, okay, you're just, the child is distressed, the caregiver comes and helps, distressed, the caregiver comes and helps. You know, you think, okay, that's just something that happens. But actually, keep in mind, this child is learning rules, very complex rules about how the world works. And so what they're learning when that happens over time is that if I need help, it'll be there. There are people who care about me. Other people can be trusted to help. And I'm someone who's worthy of help and love and kindness. So it shapes their experience of other people, the world as being a place that's generally safe, where help is available, and also themselves as being lovable and worthy of kindness and care. And they also learn how to take care of others because they're seeing care modeled, nurturing modeled, right? So that's about 60% of people. The unfortunate fact is about 40% of us have it very different. And this is not blame the parents' time. Because there's always a context, right? If parents are struggling with parenting, there's a whole context around that too. There are reasons for that. But what happens is, for whatever reason, many children are in a situation where their distress isn't consistently met with support and help and nurturing. Some of them are met with neglect, right? They're distressed and nothing happens. Nobody comes. Others, their caregivers come and try to help, but because their caregivers are so distraught or struggling in their own way, they're unable to be helpful consistently. So maybe they get so activated by the child's distress that they make it about them. Have you ever been around anyone who did that? They came in to help, but they were so activated by what was happening that they kind of freaked out. And suddenly it wasn't about the person who was suffering anymore. It was about them, right? So what happens in those situations is in that one specifically where they learn that sometimes you can get help, but oftentimes it'll disappear when you need it the most, or it's not consistent, is you can have people who learn to not feel safe in connection with others, right? They don't learn that others will help. They don't learn to feel soothed and safe through connection. And instead may even be scared of it. They may learn that, particularly if there were abuse experiences or interpersonal trauma where the people who should have cared for them hurt them, or where people that they knew hurt them, right? In that case, people can learn, the parts of our brain that learn these things can associate connection with threat, with fear, and with harm. And that's very tricky. And it's very tricky because, again, we evolved to feel safe in connection. We evolve to feel safe through connection with others who accept us and like us and care about us. So when we learn to not feel safe through connection, right? When the stuff that, according to the way our brains work, are supposed to help us feel safe, instead trigger feelings of threat, then how do we ever feel safe? You see what I'm saying? And so I think part of the background of all of this stuff that happens in our culture is the fact that we have a whole lot of people walking around through the world in almost continuous experiences of threat, right? And that's before you add on layers of sexism and racism and things like this. Because if you're a woman in this culture, you have many, many more potentially threatening experiences in your life than I have to face as a man. Right? And that's just the way it is. That's just the way the culture works right now. Right? I work at a university, so I hear these stories from my students all the time. I can walk across a crowded dance floor. I don't go dancing much, but I've been in clubs occasionally. And I've walked through many crowded dance floors, and I've never had the sexual parts of my body touched against my will. Right? I don't even think about it. I just walk across and no one's grabbing my bottom or anything else. And what I've heard from my female students is that actually you almost have to accept that that will happen if you're going to go to a dance club. That it's not even, that it happens so frequently. It's not even like, it doesn't even stand out in your experience. Right? It's like, okay, so imagine you're going through the world where there are just these bursts of threat all the time, right? As a white male, I live in a place where if I get pulled over by a police officer, number one, I'm almost certain it's because I did something wrong. And number two, there's absolutely no fear. I'm not afraid that something bad could happen to me as a result of that, There are a lot of people of color in this country who, when they see a police officer on the road, whichever way they're going, they're terrified. And they're terrified because what they've learned is that sometimes people who look just like them don't get out alive, even when they're not doing anything wrong. And so what happens when you've got tons of people going through life feeling perpetually unsafe, feeling in perpetual experiences of threat, is that you've got a lot of people who are narrowly focused on survival. And when that happens, well, think about you when you're under extreme experiences of threat. Are you at your best? Do the things that come out of your mouth represent your values? Or are you just trying to get through the moment? Right? I think we do erratic things when that happens. And so I think one of the things, if we're really going to kind of play out compassion, I'm aware that we're almost, it's 10:30, right? This is how long I go. So I'm just going to go ahead and scale it up and finish with this point. I think that if we're going to address these problems that we have in the world, one of the things we're going to have to pay attention to is how do we turn down the level of threat that's out there? How do we help one another feel safe? And by one another, I don't mean the people who are like me. In fact, I most particularly mean the people who aren't like me. How do I interact with the people who have very different views, very different political agendas, very different perspectives in ways that don't trigger experiences of threat in them? Because the moment I do that, suddenly we can't have a conversation, can we? They're focused on defending themselves. They see me as the threat. And the problem is, we live in a world, at least a country, but I don't think it's just a country. I think it's a larger world where people have learned that you can win political battles by dividing people, by causing people to feel threatened by one another. Yeah. Right? And so it's not just that we have a lot of people who developmentally feel threatened a lot. It's that we have a system that's designed to create those feelings in one another. And so I think that we absolutely, one of the things we have to do if we're going to build a more compassionate culture is we have to build a culture where more people feel safe. Because when we feel safe, our better nature can shine through. When we feel safe, whether we hate guns or whether we have a big stack of them, we can reflect on the fact that none of us want innocent children to go hungry or to die or to be shot at school. Nobody wants that, right? And we can have conversations to try and figure that out. We can only do that when we feel safe, right? When we feel threatened, then it's like, okay, protecting me and mine, right? But when we can help people, like, feel safe. And by the way, this is very tricky. And all of these problems, you think, oh, it's people are just this or people are just that. So much of this is not our fault. So much of this has to do with these tricky ways we evolved and the way our brains work. Some of you will have heard of oxytocin, right? Oxytocin is a kind of neurohormone. It's a chemical in the brain. And it was initially studied in nursing mothers, right? When a mom is breastfeeding her baby, you see massive amounts, lots of oxytocin circulating in the brain of the mom and the baby, and it's associated with pair bonding, with connection, right? And for the longest time, they thought, we could solve all these problems, you know. Oxytocin helps us feel connected with one another. We'll just hand out oxytocin gum to people. You know, they have this. They have oxytocin gum. There was this fun study that shows if you show like a chick flick, like a really moving, emotional movie to men and women, most typically, you know, the woman will cry, the men will sit there going, what? It's the reverse in my relationship, by the way. I'm the one who's like, oh my gosh, and my wife's like... But what they found is that if you give the men oxytocin gum, they're just as weepy as the women when they watch these movies. Now, it's funny how that works. And initially, you know, people were thinking, well, just hand out oxytocin gum. We'll give everyone a lifetime supply. We'll all be neat and nice to each other. We'll all feel connected. It turns out it's not that simple. You see, when we have a rush of oxytocin, when oxytocin is released in us, there is a feeling of connection and bonding to our people. So when oxytocin is released in my brain, I feel closer to my people But if there's an out group, if there are people around who I think those are a they, not an us, even as I feel closer to my people, I'm more distrustful of them.
Whoa.
Think about that for a moment. Think about that for a moment. Right? Even the chemicals that help us feel connected, as long as there's a they also drive division between us. Right? And again, the stuff our ancestors evolved to very rapidly identify threats. Our brains are designed to do this. We're designed to sort people into my people, those people, safe, dangerous, good, bad. Right? We're biased to do that. The good news again, that's the ancient part. The good news again is that we have this fancy new brain stuff that allows us to do things like focus on the commonalities we have. Right? We can use our brains to expand we so that it includes everybody. All people, and as these nuns would remind you, all beings. Right? We can include everybody. But if we don't do that, if we don't make a lot of effort to do that, then our brains will do what evolution designed them to do, which is to say, oh, like me, not like me. Good, bad, right, wrong, same, different. And then when we act those out, you know, there are lots of tragic consequences. So those are the take-home messages from this talk, I suppose. We need to find ways to help one another feel safe, to recognize that actually even all this division and the divisiveness we feel isn't our fault. We didn't design it. But we've got to take responsibility for working with it and say, given that I know this is how we work, how can I help try to experience other people in a way that builds connection rather than division? All right, go for it.
I just have something in mind because I was working for a while with women who were victims of domestic or sexual violence. And one way, and I pretty much lost faith in any psychologist after that. One of the psychologists told one of these women who is beating pretty much every day for her husband, if she was afraid to go because she didn't feel safe going out and finding her own skills and live by her own, it was okay to be there because that was her safe place. And I was like, that's not so safe. Like, everything else can be safer than be around someone that can kill you anytime when they hit you in the wrong place, no? So, like, how we can misunderstand what is safe too? Because I don't believe for a second that is safe just because you don't feel safe to go out for this cycle. So you are safe. Just be there. You will have food and a roof in your head and whatever. So how we break that cycle? Because safe place sometimes not so safe.
Well, absolutely. And I it makes me sad that any psychologist would tell someone to stay in an abusive environment. I will say in those situations it can be very tricky. This is one of the reasons for many, many generations. You've had a lot of, usually women, who have been for long periods of time in abusive situations, because if you don't have your own money, if you don't have your own finances, your own, you know, these sorts of things, it can be almost impossible to leave. Because where do you go, and how do you live, and how do you buy food, and how do you support yourself? So that's very tricky. So for me, the way I would work with that as a therapist is to be very aware of the resources that are in communities that can help women like that. So for example, in Spokane, we've got some places like Transitions, which is a place that's specifically for women who need a place to live, women and children who need a place to live to help them kind of do that. But that can be really tough. So I think you're right. The other person, the other part, the situation kind of you're highlighting there is for that person, where is the safe place? Right? Is the safe place her home, where there's a lot of stuff that she likes about there, but there's an active abuser too? Or is the safe place somewhere other than home, where she's not being abused, but everything else feels unfamiliar and different and scary? And that's really tricky. And that's, again, why we need these kind of social support systems, so we can connect her when she gets out, so she's not on her own and alone, but there are people there that can help her and support her.
We don't have them.
What?
We don't have
them. And you don't have them. And that's the problem, right? So one of the things that I would encourage all of you to do, and of course, we can't do everything, right?
Yeah.
But you might be surprised that you can do more than you think. And what happens if you can go back into community and say, hey, this is a problem? And maybe some culture or some context you can't. But there are a lot of places. I have a graduate student who's from rural Montana, right? And she's saying the same thing. In the place I live, there's no place. If you're being abused, there's no place to go. There's no shelters or things like this. There's no services. And so her dream is to move back and basically to try and partner with the local resources there to create something like that. But I think it's very tricky. But I think what you find is when you start to share that compassionate intention, this is a problem and I want to do something about it, and you put it out there, and the internet can be useful in that way, it allows other people who have noticed the same thing and who have the same problems and the same visions to say, to come together, right? And sometimes things are possible that you didn't think they were possible, because when I think about how do I do this, it seems too much, but it's not how do I do this. It's can I find a we, and can we do this, right? And this is, again, why connecting with Sangha, with community members, with people who have a compassionate intent and this desire to be helpful can help. But I think it's important that what you said, because there aren't easy answers to these problems. But I think it starts by recognizing them and connecting with the intent to try and find a way to do something that might be helpful.